This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Sick and tired of petty office politics, that claustrophobic cubicle getting you down, looking for a new and unconventional career path? Well, there's a world of opportunity and easy money in pharmaceutical trials. In a recent article for Wired magazine, Josh McHugh wrote about the growing subculture of what he calls drug test cowboys, human guinea pigs who volunteer to participate in clinical trials for a price. For some, it's a quick and easy way to pay off a college debt. For others, a way to tide themselves over between jobs. And a few have managed to turn it into a career. The perks include flexible hours and relatively little responsibility. The downside, uncomfortable and potentially dangerous side effects. And, well, you know, these are experiments. If you've ever been a human lab rat, call and tell us what it was, how much you got paid, whether it was worth it. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org, and you can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Later on in the program, why the FCC should stay out of the debate over violence on television. But first, drug test cowboys. Josh McHugh is a contributing editor to Wired magazine and the author of the article Drug Test Cowboys. He joins us now from the studios of KQED, our member station in San Francisco. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me on.
And you interviewed some of these human guinea pigs. What did they say when you asked them why they did it?
They had a variety of reasons. I think one of the deepest reasons for all of them is that it's a pretty original way to make a living, that they're sort of giving the bird to the system. They all have a very subversive kind of a vibe to them.
Well, you cite a famous incident from Britain where people got seriously ill in one of these studies just last year. This can be dangerous.
It can indeed. Yeah, the guys in the UK really had a bad time of it. There were, I guess, 8 subjects. 6 of them got this compound called TGN-1412, and 2 of them got placebos. And the 6 who got the compound basically endured terrible organ damage when the compound turned their T cells against them.
Mm-hmm. And presumably, when you sign up for one of these things, one of the things you do when you say, I'll accept money for this is sign a waiver saying you don't have too many rights if things go wrong.
That's true. It's interesting. I think they're starting some legal proceedings against the company that ran the testing in the UK case. So we'll see how that shakes out. But it's very clear in most cases, exactly what is what's going to happen during the experiment. The only thing that's not crystal clear is the results, the effects.
Well, a lot of these testers to see whether these things are safe or not, and right. Sometimes they're not. And I assume the riskier it is, the more intrusive the kinds of tests you have to endure, the more money you can make.
That's right. A few of the guys I talked to mentioned that in some European countries, the controls are a little less stringent than what the FDA requires here, and that the result is that the money is better.
And how much money can somebody make?
Well, the folks that I talked about making $10,000 for a 3-week inpatient study. Those aren't very common, and that's part of the skill of making a living being a professional guinea pig is finding those high-paying studies and getting into them.
And making sure you can qualify for them because, for one thing, this was fascinating. You can't be too fit.
Well, in my case, for sure, what they were looking for was the study that I did, they were looking for someone with an average American diet and at an average or below average level of fitness. And it was a shock to me at the time, but I qualified easily in both of those categories.
And your particular test was the one trial that you were, it was the Paleolithic diet?
That's right.
And so you were eating, what, a lot of raw food?
I was eating nothing, no processed foods, no salt, and no dairy. So I was eating vegetables, fruits, and meat.
Mm-hmm.
All day, every day for 17 days in a row.
No salt, no sugar, nothing like that.
That's right. I mean, only what was already in the foods, you know, whatever salt is in, you know, pork and chicken from their diets, and then the sugar from the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
I could see how this might give you a desperate urge for a little Tabasco sauce, but other than that, it doesn't sound too terrible.
Well, it doesn't. The hard thing about it was really the monotony, and also just lugging around an immense amount of food, because the average American diet is so densely packed with calories. You don't have to eat all that much to get a ton of calories. So when you go back to the Paleolithic
mm-hmm.
menu, you actually need a lot of food to make up the normal caloric intake.
So you lost weight, you reported. Your cholesterol levels looked terrific afterwards.
That's right. It was a ringing success, the diet was. And I only found out after the test that going into it, my insulin resistance was at a level that they called pre-diabetic.
Hmm.
So and then when I was finished with the test, it was sort of in a very, very acceptable range. So it worked.
Our guest is Josh McHugh, a contributing editor to Wired Magazine, author of the article Drug Test Cowboys. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. And you can also check out our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Margo. Margo with us from Fort Myers in Florida.
Hi.
Hi.
So glad to be on. I did a birth control test for about 6 months on a pill that was on the market, but the patent was up.
Mm-hmm.
So they reformulated it, and they had to redo all the tests. So I felt very safe in it because it was already something that was on the market. I got free medical care for 6 months, and just with relationship to the pill. And it's $75 when I'm done, which is next week.
And the testing for this, what, did they come by and take blood every once in a while or something?
Well, and what they did was I had to fill out a diary every day saying, you know, how my body was reacting to the pill, if things were, you know, just how things were, and I would call the nurse if I felt there was a problem. They also gave me lots of free pregnancy tests to keep at home in case I was afraid that maybe the pill wasn't working. So that's $40 a pack that I'm saving and just have this stashed away. It wasn't certainly not something I could make a career with, but it was a positive thing, you know, for the last 6 months. Saves a little bit of money, and after next week I'll have a little bit more in my pocket, and no harm, no foul.
Thanks very much. I was interested, Josh McHugh, you write in your piece that researchers need 10 million human test subjects every year.
That's right. There are a lot of drugs in development, and you know, every pharmaceutical company is cranking through as many new compounds as they can, trying to beat everybody else to the market with the next Viagra or and hopefully not the next Vioxx.
Yeah. Joining us now is Robert Helms. He's the editor and principal author of the zine Guinea Pig Zero. He's participated in his share of clinical trials over the years. He's with us by phone from Philadelphia. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hello, Neil.
And
glad to be here.
Oh, good. You're not on the phone. You're in a studio. Where are you?
Yes, at RTI in Philadelphia.
Okay. There's the radio station there in Philadelphia. Nice to talk to you. And Josh McHugh was saying earlier on that there's sort of a subversive streak in a lot of the people who do this. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. It's viewed as an occupation, as a job, not as some kind of altruistic activity for
mm-hmm.
humanity. Especially in my case, I can't afford health care, so whatever benefits to humanity, I'm going to be at the back of the line if I ever need it. I'd say there's a subversive streak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
how did you get into that line of work?
Well, I left a good paying job as a union organizer, and a lot of my friends in West Philadelphia had been doing these things for quite a while, for years,
mm-hmm.
and were in some cases, were living only on that income. And so I just got together a list of phone numbers from them, and they told me what to say and what not to say, and I was in very good health. And I really did qualify and all that. So I just went and tried it out.
And I understand from Josh McHugh's article in Wired Magazine that you were among the people who really was instrumental in getting better pay for a lot of these people.
Well, I did a lot of things. I wrote report cards on research units from the guinea pig's perspective in the early issues, mm-hmm. and in most of the issues of the scene. And some of these got quite a bit of attention. I, in fact, got sued by a hospital chain in Philadelphia once, and it started to get a lot of media coverage, sometimes on a national level in the late 90s. So the complaints I was making were getting, a lot of circulation, and were being talked about by, all the...
But he writes that basically in one trial, you sort of organized everybody,
that's,
got a petition
that's
up,
right.
demanded
that,
more money, and said, we're all going to walk out unless you give us some more money.
Well, we didn't put it quite that bluntly, but we made noise sort of like on the side so that the nurses were overhearing us talking about walking out. This is at the other end of my time doing guinea pig work. This is the second from the last study I did. We complained, and I wrote up a petition, and we just made noises about leaving before the end of the study to get into a better paying study that pays us fairly. And the nurses had a period of time when they were negotiating with the drug manufacturer, which is where the money comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally they
saw the light.
They gave in, and they gave us an $800 pay increase each. And
pretty substantial.
Yes, we thought so.
We're talking with Josh McHugh of Wired Magazine and Robert Helm, editor and principal author of the zine Guinea Pig Zero. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little bit later in the program, we'll hear an argument that the FCC should stay out of the debate over violence on TV. But right now we're talking about drug test cowboys. These are healthy people who serve as human lab rats and get paid for it, often as a one-shot, but sometimes as a temporary job. And for some people, it's a career. Josh McHugh wrote the article Drug Test Cowboys for the current issue of Wired Magazine. He's still with us from KQED in San Francisco. Also with us, Robert Helm, editor and principal author of the zine Guinea Pig Zero. He's with us from WRTI in Philadelphia. And if you've been a human guinea pig, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Carrie. Carrie with us on the line from Boise, Iowa. That's got to be Idaho, yes.
Hi, I used to conduct clinical trials for about 10 years here in Boise,
mm-hmm.
and I did women's trials, and a lot of the women I saw were elderly women who didn't have health insurance and who were not going to get any kind of routine medical costs or care if they weren't in these trials. And I had a lot of women who would go, as we called them, rolling from trial to trial because it was how they got their medical coverage.
How did they deal? I mean, this is not an easy thing to do sometimes.
It's not, because you really do have to lay a lot of your personal life for some of these trials out. And some of them require a major psychological component. And you have to be pretty honest, and there's a lot of invasive testing. And may not necessarily pay a lot, but they get a lot of free medical attention. And a lot of women like the attention, because in clinical trials you see people, you see your coordinator so much more often, they like seeing that one-on-one attention more frequently.
Robert Helm, the free medical care, I guess that's part of the attraction.
No, it sometimes does occur that, a good number of times, like, a person will discover that they have an illness because they have the screening. Or I remember a girl who found out she had leukemia by screening for a study, and now she's dead. I don't think that it should be considered medical care. I think it should be a small consideration in the big picture, because it's already not fair that the person doesn't have medical care that they can afford, or good medical care that they can afford. So if you say that it's compensation to get some free medical care when you're, well, if you're talking about someone like me, you're healthy in the first place, but it's really I consider free medical care as an advertisement of part of the benefits of doing the study is kind of a curveball.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In my personal opinion, and in many people's opinion, because it's just the subject is doing the company a service. It's not the other way around.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder, Josh McHugh, did other people mention this when you talked to them?
Yeah, a couple of the guys sort of pointed it out. I don't think it was the primary reason for that particular career choice. But, one fellow I wrote about in Florida, he said that he had worked other jobs. He'd been a contractor and hit his thumb with a hammer and seen guys get electrocuted. And he said, if anything goes wrong with me while I'm on this job, I'll definitely get medical attention.
All right. Carrie, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
So long. Let's see if we can talk now with Susan. And Susan with us from Denver, Colorado.
Yes. I am in a drug trial. For Botox equivalent, I'm seeing one of the leading dermatologists in Denver, and during my original examination, they discovered I had facial skin cancer.
Hmm. So in this case, the screening turned out to be to your benefit.
Yes, and I'm getting free treatment of the lines on my forehead with a drug that's been used in 60 other countries.
So you feel pretty secure about it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Judge. Very good doctor.
Yeah, thanks very much. Good luck with it.
All right. Thank you.
And Josh McHugh, one of the fascinating things about your article was the amount of preparation that these people go to going online to find out what studies are available, what they need to qualify for it, how long these substances that they're going to be using will be in their system so that they know how long before they can get into the next clinical trial.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things that that Bob Helms mentioned to me when we first talked, was that the half-life of the compounds that are being tested is a really significant piece of data for professional guinea pigs to have.
Mm. And I wonder, Bob Helms,
yes?
There's preparation that you need to go to for a trial.
Well, you have to be free of drugs. Usually you can't smoke. You can't be a smoker. And you can't even take vitamins. But you also have to understand that you're competing with other people for the same slot in the same drug study. So you have to not start going into every little detail of every little fine point of your real medical history. You have to just go there and be a healthy person.
I see.
And so if you go in to say, my aunt just came down with a cancer and blah, 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 you're just giving them work that doesn't, they don't need to know, and they don't really want to know unless you tell them. Then it's their job to deal with the information. So, and also one thing that came up in the article, and Josh, I love the article. It's very fine. But the thing about the poppy seeds.
Ah, poppy seed bagels. Yeah.
I used to believe in it for years, and I used to talk about it all the time. But
that it would show up as opiates
in a
drug
test. It's, you'd have to drink like a pint glass of poppy seeds and an hour later be tested, and it would come up a trace amount. It's not like a heroin reading.
Hmm. Robert Helms, I understand that you're now retired from active participation in clinical trials.
Right. I turned 46, and then I was out of the 18 to 45 range, which is usually what they need.
Ah, so you're no longer in the desirable demographic,
right? And I tried to get into a few in France after that, and my French wasn't good enough, so they they played it by the book and didn't let me in.
Robert Helms, thanks very much for being with us today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Robert Helms, editor and principal author of the zine Guinea Pig Zero. He joined us today from WRTI in Philadelphia. Obviously, there are ethical implications to human testing. To talk more about that, we've called on Arthur Kaplan, chair of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the books Smart Mice, Not So Smart People. He's with us today from our bureau in Chicago. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hey, how are you, Neil?
And there is obviously a board set up that screens. What are the procedures you have to go through before you start testing stuff on human beings?
Well, basically, research involves sometimes medicines, sometimes not. When it's going to be a drug or a device, you start with animals, and then there's a group of people that are going to get that medicine first. That's going to be a safety study. So the first group of humans know that it's been tested on animals, but that doesn't always tell them that it's safe. And so you're going to try it in human beings, that first group, probably 20 or 30 people, and they're going to try and see how much of a dose you can tolerate. Then the next step is to see if you can figure out what dose actually has some biological effect. That's phase two.
Mm-hmm.
Phase three is testing the thing that has the biological effect in a lot of people. And phase four is Vioxx. That's when it's actually prescribed, but you're still supposed to report the side effects back. So most of what we're talking about here today for medicines is people in phase one, the safety studies.
Mm-hmm.
But, Neil, you can also do studies if you have pesticides or bleach or perfume or underarm deodorant. Somebody's got to stick that on their skin and see whether it causes a problem. Those are simply safety studies. They have nothing to do with coming up with a drug or a medicine. And that goes on, too. There's a lot of human testing that people get paid for that. And occasionally there's a study where the researcher just wants to understand how the human body functions. Let's say I want to know how long I can keep somebody awake and have them performing tasks. Or I want to see whether three people can get along in a small space because I'm trying to figure out how to get people to Mars. Those are what we call challenge studies. They're not aimed at a drug. They're not aimed at a device. They're kind of aimed at understanding how human beings function. And there's some hilarious anecdotes that come out of the paid world of sleep deprivation studies, which I've been in myself, as a matter of fact.
Let me ask you about that in a minute. But I did want to say, obviously, there's the example of the infamous Tuskegee incident, the syphilis study years ago. And then there's also been controversy over testing of prisoners, which used to be done as well, where there was, you know, voluntary cooperation. Was it really voluntary or not? All of these, the practices, the ethical practices, as there are today, have benefited from these sometimes disastrous mistakes of the past?
They have. Routinely, in the 1940s, 50s, people would have said experimentation is risky, a nasty business, and something that you'd do on people in institutions or prisoners or people who you thought were inferior, like African-American people at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You really exploited people with disabilities, people on grounds of race. What's shifted is today we think of research as relatively safe. Very few people are injured in research or harmed. It's a tiny number of people. And for many diseases, you don't have to twist anybody's arm to get into research. They're lining up if they have Parkinsonism or depression or disseminated cancer. They want to be in research. So the protections that have evolved from Tuskegee, from the prison experiments, from the Nazi concentration camp experiments are basically three things. First, you have to give informed consent. And so everybody gets a form that says, here's the risks, here's the benefits, here's what we're doing. Secondly, it has to be approved by a board called an institutional review board to make sure that the research protocol is reasonable and to make sure that the information that the subject gets is honest. In the Tuskegee study, everybody gave consent. They just lied to them and said they were giving them treatment. The third thing is to make sure that any conflicts of interest that the researcher has are disclosed. So if I'm signing you up to be in a study and I'm paying you, but I get paid $100 a head every person I recruit into the study, in theory, I'm supposed to disclose that, although I'll tell you, Neil, it doesn't always happen.
I bet not. You're one of the people who advocate that if doctors are going to conduct experiments on human beings, they ought to do it on themselves as well.
I do. I think that, obviously, certain types of research you can't do on yourself. If you are trying to study skin cancer and you don't have it, the doctor can't do anything about that.
Right.
But if you're going to say, you know, I think this is a relatively mild safety study and this substance can be put on your skin, I think you should put it on your own skin first. There's been a long history in medicine of doing the first experiment on yourself. You know what a heart catheterization is, where we sort of wind a wire up into your heart to take a look at what's going on in there. It comes up through a artery in your leg.
Mm-hmm.
The first person who did that did it on himself, Werner Forsman, in his own lab.
Well, they've also named a famous hospital for Walter Reed.
That's right. And so yellow fever experiments, many, many experiments traditionally were done first with at least the researcher being able to say, look, this isn't so dangerous. It isn't so nasty. I've done it. I can tell you about it. Mm. Now, what's happened in recent times as we've gone to this more market-driven business of research is the researchers don't worry about it. They figure that people are getting paid, and literally they don't care as much.
Hmm. We're talking with Arthur Kaplan, director of the University of Pennsylvania Studies for Bioethics, and Josh McHugh, a contributor to Wired magazine, about drug test cowboys. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Paul. Paul with us from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. I love NPR. I love doing drug studies. I've been doing them full-time for 2 years now.
For 2 years?
2 years.
And how many studies have you participated in?
I guess I should have thought of that when I was on hold. I would say 15, 20.
15 or 20, and you get typically paid how much?
What's funny is when I was listening, I remembered that the first study I ever did was $75 for some nasal spray study where I had to, you know, do the diary and call in.
Mm-hmm.
I found out about the big $1,000 ones, and so most of the studies I do are $2,000 to, I guess the biggest one I ever did was $11,000.
Wow. Josh McHugh, you it's right that some people might make $40,000, $50,000 a year on doing this, which is not all that much more than a barista makes. Nevertheless, there are some benefits.
Benefits. How do you mean?
You don't have to work very hard.
That is a huge benefit. I mean, you know, the study I did was small potatoes from a money point of view, because it was pretty much guaranteed to be at least not harmful, and possibly, as mm-hmm. it was in the end, beneficial. But the nice thing about it is that you get this feeling of sort of being taken care of. You know, the nurses and the researchers in my study were all, you know, very professional and just and very nice. And you're sort of almost being waited on hand and foot. I mean, you have a lot of free time. And, you know, some guys use the free time to do research on other clinical studies that are coming up to visit next and do the screenings for.
Paul, how much longer are you going to be doing this?
Until I'm forced to do something otherwise, I guess, until something changes in my life. I love doing studies. I feel healthiest when I'm in them. I love to travel. I love the free time. I met my lovely girlfriend, Kamala, who I love very much. Hello, Kamala. In a drug study. So I guess until we get married and decide to have a family, I'm going to be doing them for the next couple of years.
Well, Paul, good luck.
And I do have one thing to bring up about, you know, from doing studies from the inside. A lot of places, if you tell them that you have side effects,
mm-hmm.
they'll drop you from the study and only pay you a prorated amount. And so I've seen a ton of people who do this on a regular basis conceal and not tell the study people your side effects in fear that they're going to get kicked out and get a lesser dollar amount. So I think that's one problem with the industry. But other than that, I haven't really had hardly any side effects, and none of them serious. So I think it's good business.
All right, Paul, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And good luck to you. Here's an email from Jules via the blog. I perform clinical trial compliance work at Duke University, and most well-designed trials contain provision language that would disallow a guinea pig from participating in too many trials. This prevents conflicts of drug interaction and hopefully keeps the trial real. And I guess Arthur Kaplan, that's one of the safety factors that people have to take into account.
Well, let me cast a little pall over this line of work in the following ways. If you're getting paid a lot of money, as the caller just pointed out, people often don't report side effects. That is the problem of paying more and more cash. They're trying to figure out, is a drug safe? Is a product going to cause itchy skin or an allergic reaction? And if you're in there getting 10 grand and you want to keep getting it and it's your line of work, then you just don't bring up the fact that you felt nauseous 4 nights in a row. So that is a problem with these studies. I also know that there are people who definitely multiply enroll in studies.
Oh, Josh writes about them, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a problem because you're supposed to, if you will, have no drug interaction. But if the money's good and you want to go shopping, there are definitely people who lie and just sign up for more than one.
Josh McHugh's article, Drug Test Cowboys, is in the current issue of Wired magazine. Josh, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on, Neil.
And also thanks to Arthur Kaplan, director of the University of Pennsylvania Center for Bioethics. When we come back, should the FCC be involved in legislating violence on TV? This is NPR News.